Hi, it's Friday, and welcome to a very special edition of the Zodker Report, Real and Unscripted. It's a special edition because we have a very special guest today, Parag Khanna, an author, public intellectual, millennial, and colleague. I am a very big fan of Parag. I have read almost all of the books that he has authored and have been a huge fan now for a number of years. Good morning and welcome, Parag. How are you in Singapore?
John, I'm great. It's good to see you, and the feeling is mutual.
Well, thank you. That's a very good start then. We're going to be talking about Parag's newest book entitled Move, The Forces Uprooting Us, published by Simon & Schuster and available any day now in the next few days. I want to tell you first a little bit about our author and our guest today, and then we've got some questions about him and about the book. Parag Khanna is a native of India and has lived in the United Arab Emirates and in New York City. He has 3 degrees, 2 from Georgetown, a bachelor's degree in international affairs from the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and a master's in security studies, also from Georgetown. His PhD at the London School of Economics is in international relations. Today, he spends his time as a geopolitical advisor and a fellow at leading universities and think tanks, actually all over the world. Multiple TED Talks. He lives in the beautiful city of Singapore, which I've had a chance to visit. Author of 6 books, this book, Move, is now his 7th book. And we're going to get into it in some detail. But Parag, let's start. Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Why this book and why now?
Well, thank you again, John. Thank you so much. And I think the twain have finally met, because I think this is the appropriate book for you and I to be conversing about, given all the work you've done globally in researching demographics and values and attitudes, because today's youth are the central protagonists of this book. But to step back, why this book? Well, this is a book about human geography, and geography is the subject closest to my heart. As a traveler, as a researcher, and as an academic. And I've written about sort of political geography. I've written about functional geography, meaning infrastructure and supply chains and so forth. But I hadn't written a book about human geography, which is our distribution around the world, our demographics, our locations, and how that is changing, and forecasting how that's going to change amidst the backdrop of climate change and demographic deflation. The fact that the world population is reaching a plateau, climate change is accelerating, making many places unlivable and other places livable. So where will you live in 2030? Where will you live in 2040? Where will you live in 2050? Can we generate answers to those questions using a complexity kind of toolkit, you know, and say, well, demographics and labor markets and technology and politics and climate change or economic crises, all pushing people in different directions. Are there patterns? Is there a logic? Are there stable places where humanity can resettle? And those are the big questions that I wanted to tackle in this book. And even though right now we are all locked down, therefore, it would seem to be the most paradoxical moment in all of history to be writing a book about mobility, there's no question that we will be moving again, because all of those driving forces are actually in overdrive. So the pent-up demand for people to move is higher than ever.
Have humans been in this condition before? It's one thing to talk about changes in climate, another thing to be talking about political unrest and revolts, a whole other thing to be talking about the downfall of governments and institutions. We seem to have a convergence of all of those plus more. Is this the first time that humans are facing this much all at once?
Short answer, yes. Long answer, I'm glad you raised this point, that to put it in layman's terms, you don't get to pick your crisis, early in the pandemic, people were talking about the lockdown as the solution to climate change. Well, of course, as Hurricane Ida and, you know, countless other catastrophes have reminded us, you don't get to have a neat sequence of today I'll deal with the pandemic, tomorrow I'll deal with the, you know, unwinding the economic bailouts, and on the third day I'll deal with climate change. We are being hit, and on the fourth day I'll deal with Afghanistan and the new refugee crisis, right? All of these things at the same time. That's how the real world works. It is complex. And to say that, you know, at what other time in the past could all of humanity simultaneously facing this barrage and clash and collision of these mega trends at the same time? No, it could not possibly have, you know, ever been as intense and complex as it is today.
And you have dealt with each of those elements in your previous work. That's why I'm so glad to have read this book, this latest, which focuses on humans and not simply on geography or infrastructure or governance and the like. You say something early on in the book that really captivated me. Connectivity is destiny, you said, as a prelude to the increased mobility that we are experiencing as humans and that is only going to accelerate. What do you mean when you say connectivity is destiny?
Well, that was actually the sort of motto of the prequel to this book, right? Connectography was about how we have built so much infrastructure in particularly the last 100 years and across borders to enable global supply chains to flourish, to have an integrated world economy, and so forth. But now, by bringing in the human layer, the motto of this book becomes mobility is destiny, because what are we going to do with all of that connectivity? We're going to use it to move ourselves and to move things. Actually, the book, that, you know, the phrase mobility is destiny denotes not just the mobility of people, it's the mobility of everything. It's the mobility of capital, it's the mobility of goods, the mobility of technology, mobility of ideas, and humans at the same time. So I think that that's part of the swirl of mobility that connectivity enables and allows. And remember, we continue to build more and more of that connectivity. Just think about the digital domain, which is accelerated as a result of the pandemic, right? Less physical mobility, more digital dependency, more time on Zoom calls, more internet cables being laid down around the world, and so forth. So it's never a good time, quite frankly, for people to make long-term, you know, predictions about the death of globalization. We will continue to use these globe-spanning infrastructures and networks in many different ways. You know, I'm, I guess, old enough, strangely, it's a weird vibe to say, you know, four times in the last 20 years, I have heard people speak about confidently about the death of globalization. The 9/11 terrorist attacks 20 years ago, right? The financial crisis, 2007-2008. Trump and Brexit in 2016. And now COVID. And I don't lose any sleep at night in claiming with full confidence that it's been was wrong then and it's going to be wrong now. You know, globalization always wins. Mobility always wins. Entropy, in a way, is this overriding force that is going to continue to animate us.
You also say that survival, you talk about the survival of the mobile. And it reminds me that, you know, in its most visible form, we see here in the States, Central Americans and those south of our border, under the worst imaginable conditions, leaving terrible conditions, traveling under worse conditions, reaching even worst conditions. We see it with Syrian and Libyan refugees. We see it with refugees actually all over the world. We see, despite growth rates in Africa, a continent projected, what, to have 1.2 billion people that it can't possibly sustain. And yet there are powerful political forces in wealthier countries that are trying to prevent mobility, saying it's not sustainable. We cannot possibly absorb these people. How do you see it playing out? And that, albeit that's the lower end of the spectrum. We haven't even gotten to the middle and higher end of the spectrum, where you have folks actually looking for work, looking for real opportunities. But tell me, are we going to be able to stop mobility? Are you going to be able to build walls and barriers?
I mean, the rational question is, why would you want to, right? When you don't begin answer the question from the perspective of this land is our land, from an, in an ethno-nationalist kind of way, but rather say, what is the most effective way to maximize the survival of the human species and actually enrich our societies and economies, then you would actually want more migration. It's certainly not a matter of space constraints. We are now 8 billion people and will probably not reach 9 billion people. Every human being standing together side by side would fit in a very, very small place, actually, you know, a city. And yet we have 150 million square kilometers of habitable terrain in the world, more than half of that actually in, you know, areas with sufficient water supply and water basins. So there's hardly a place in the world where you would say, oh, it's, you know, sort of too crowded. You know, it's that we are an attractive place to be, but we certainly shouldn't let more people in. Now, I am as concerned as anyone about the tragedy of the commons effects that can occur if you have uncontrolled mass migration. And if you were to do so in democratic societies in particular, you might engender a cultural and political backlash that would kill the golden goose. And you don't want to do that. So you want to do these things in a managed way. And part of what scenario forecasting and the scenarios that I put forward in the book is about is saying there are certain things that are inevitable in light of climate change and political unrest and destitution and violence that will push people away from where they are. They are going to be coming in this time horizon, or they're here already. It's actually a very sound and wise idea to encourage their assimilation rather than, you know, sort of having ghettos or pushing them back and, you know, in potentially fueling more violence and unrest. And so let's focus on doing this pragmatically and correctly and in a humane way, in a mutually beneficial way, in a dispassionate way, rather than in a reactive and punitive way. That's what I would like us to get to. And believe it or not, you know, it's not as naive as it sounds for a couple of reasons. First of all, when I say mass migration, some people say, oh my goodness, you know, how could we ever manage that? This is, you know, sort of terra incognita. No, it's not. The last 200 years of world history has been characterized by mass migrations, the vast majority of which has been orderly, peaceful, stable, mutually beneficial, enriching our societies. America wouldn't be what it is if the last 200 years of history were not characterized by stable and orderly mass migration, right? So this is not even remotely terra incognita. This is a logical continuation of where we've been. Secondly, if you look at Canada and you even look at now Biden administration immigration policy, and you look at Brexit or England now after Brexit and Germany and so forth, you still have very large scale migration. Despite the backlash in Germany against the Syrian refugee influx, despite Brexit, it's easier to migrate to the UK right now than in 2015 before Brexit, right? So you would be right to ask, what was that about then? Canada is increasing its population by, you know, 1%, 400,000 people every single year. So the world is not dominated by populist, xenophobic, you know, anti-immigrant regimes, not by a mile.
No, and it's amazing to me the degree to which it dominates public talk and policy discussion. I'm just going to interject here for a moment that I actually live in a very small city in upstate New York, one third of which is refugee and the children of refugees. And we have absorbed these communities from Burma and Bosnia and the Sudan, Libya, the Ukraine, Bhutan. There are 46 languages spoken in the local public school system, and yet no organized opposition, and the boon to the local economy is widely praised by a lot of folks. You know, it raises a fascinating policy question to me, because we hear in this country and in Europe a lot of talk about, well, the jobs are there, but nobody that wants to do them. So employers are facing a crisis. And yet here we have hundreds of thousands of folks stuck at the border who would be more than happy to do the lower wage kinds of jobs, simply because, like all other immigrants prior to that, it's their children then that are going to populate the community colleges and the public universities, go on and graduate and make the contributions to the education system and to the broader economy. Your book is very, very timely. You alluded to just now, and in the book you write in great detail, about four scenarios that we could face regarding mobility. If you would, could you just outline the worst case scenario and then the best case scenario? And then I have some follow-up questions to that. If nothing is done, or if public blockage, public policy blockage occurs to this mobility, what's the worst case scenario?
The title of the worst case scenario in the book is called The New Middle Ages. And on the axes that I draw in the book, that is in the quadrant that is the least sustainable environmentally and has the least amount of mobility and migration. So people are stuck where they are as the global ecosystem degenerates and we and supply chains break down and we resort to kind of local hunter-gatherer kinds of practices, and everyone suffers, but not equally. So that's the new Middle Ages, a very fragmented, low sustainability, low migration world. The opposite quadrant in the scenario matrix in the book is what I call Northern Lights. And in Northern Lights, we have a much more fluid, a gradual, controlled, orderly recirculation, relocation, resettlement of the world population. We aspire to preserve those remaining human lives in a world that's actually a very finite world population of 8 billion people, and we don't want it to collapse too rapidly, even with low fertility. And generally speaking, people are moving in the direction of south to north, but it's not that simple because you've got forest fires and flooding and typhoons and rising sea levels all across the northern hemisphere as well. So we have to choose our climate oases, as I call them, our kind of stable habitats very carefully. And we have to pre-design our infrastructures, our settlements, along the lines of the technologies that we very much have available today, in which our settlements, large and small, collect rainwater and recycle gray water and channel it into hydroponic agriculture, and we use solar and wind power and 3D printed housing that can even be moved to cope with and avoid natural disasters. And we do that for billions of people. So that's the Northern Light scenario. Now, we have every technology available to us today to literally move 8 billion people to, you know, more stable habitats than they live in right now. Or let's say the 4 billion people who are most at risk. We could do it with all of the grounded airlines, we can do it with trains, we can do it with ferries, but I don't want to be naive. But the purpose of a scenario is to say it's a vision of four different visions. Whether it's the most likely or least likely is not the issue. It's, is it desirable or not desirable, or what aspects of it are desirable? And what would we do to get from A to B? And the answer is never really a global one, as much as we would like to have global visions and a consistent global kind of doctrine, because the one area of sovereignty, the one arena, the one vestige of sovereignty that remains, you know, fully in the writ and purview of national governments is, of course, the control over their borders for the movement of people. Governments can't control the flow of drugs, of viruses, of cyber hacks, right? But they can stop people from moving back and forth. And we will never have one common global accord or compact on migration. But we will have new pairs emerging in the movement of people as we adapt to a climate change world and to other crises and to labor market shortages and so forth. And it's those new dyads that I explore a lot in the geographic chapters of the book, where I look at, you know, Asian populations in Canada, not just in the United States. And I look at South Asians moving to Europe and into Russia and so forth. So the past will not simply be a restart and a return to the pre-pandemic world, to the 20th century patterns or the 19th century patterns. There will literally be new geographic vectors in the movement of people between now and 2030, 2040, 2050.
What has drawn me to you and your reading and your writing is the fact that you're the optimist in the room. I am too. And so it's good to meet the other optimist in the world. You remain an optimist.
I call myself an accidental optimist, you know, sort of, you know, I'm very sort of data driven, as you know, and, you know, one of my previous books, when I looked at infrastructural connectivity, I said, well, if you look at China's Belt and Road Initiative and you look at the competitive connectivity over infrastructure and trade routes, it may seem like a neo-colonial, neo-imperial effort, but the sum total of all of those neo-self-interested efforts to build infrastructure and trade corridors for one's own benefit, such as China, the net result of that is actually creating a system of infrastructure linkages that benefits everyone and creates more systemic resilience, because now you can get more energy and more resources and move things from place A to place B. And if a ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal, you can now send things by railway or take the Arctic route or whatever the case may be, because we've built these pathways. So I didn't set out to be an optimist about when writing about Chinese grand strategy, which is clearly imperial in design. But you accidentally become an optimist because you can see how it can be used for other non-intended but beneficial purposes. So I'm kind of the accidental optimist here when it comes to climate change, which is obviously a horrific existential threat. But what is happening at the same time with demographic deflation is that countries are realizing that they need people just as uninhabitable places need to be vacated. And so perhaps, and I don't want to be optimistic about this, but I want to chart the path, perhaps our political ideology and vision and policies will see this scenario playing out and say, wait a minute, we're losing people, but we're livable just at the time that we need people from unlivable places. So it's actually supply and demand, you know, that is really the most powerful law of all of history, is just supply and demand. And I think that the supply and demand of people is the story I'm trying to tell.
And you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about how the G7 has just, in a memorandum of understanding, indicated its desire to build a counter to the new Silk Road by China, which in its most negative can mean trouble and economic and political conflict, but in its most positive, just what you mentioned here, just another pathway to enable the movement of people and goods and services. Your book is a real find for me. It's something that I will review once it comes out and share with others. I hope that you folks are inspired, those of you who are listening and watching. Here's the book on the screen. It's available around October 12th or so, and I hope that you'll buy it. Read it too. That's always good, but at least in the first instance, buy it. Parag, what a nice opportunity this has been to chat. I hope we covered everything that you'd like covered. Is there anything that we missed that you'd like to point out before we sign off?
Well, John, you know, I think you and I share a real passion in understanding the motivations of the world's youth. So I just want to emphasize, you know, that the youth values that you and I have tracked, and I've learned so much from your work on this, mobility, sustainability, connectivity. Let's start to view the future from the point of view of young people. And again, design the world that in a way that's going to be most accommodating to their needs.
I couldn't agree with you more. What a delight. Let's do this again sometime.
Would love to. Thank you.
Take care. And thanks for watching and listening, folks. And I'll be back with Jeremy next week.